Welcome back to the TV Talk Machine. It's episode number 93. This is a fraudulent episode that was recorded last week because Tim is going to be going to Beverly Hills to visit the Death March with Cocktails, and I'm going to be in San Diego.
Friend. Mm-hmm.
So I'm Jason Snell. He's Tim Goodman. We mm-hmm. are not here.
We are in the ether.
We are.
I'm in a hotel trapped. Get me.
We're in holograms. We're holograms of ourselves.
Exactly. It's exactly
from the past, projected into the future. So this is a letters episode. I'm sure some huge news happened. I'm sure somebody announced something amazing at Comic-Con on Sunday. I'm sure there were big stories this week happening the whole week. We didn't see any of it because we recorded this last week. So forget about timely topics. Instead, we're gonna read some of your letters.
Yeah, if they're saying, why are they not talking about X? Oh, because X is super huge and amazing and everybody's talking about it. Well, we're not here.
If it happened after July 22nd, we don't know about it.
We don't know about it.
Why are we whispering?
I don't know.
Okay. I heard a couple of really nice letters. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about the A word. You really recommended people who might have missed it. And we got this is one of those things I think it's nice about you shining a light on a show that's really good that people might miss. On Twitter, we got something from DM who said, I loved episode one of the A word. Thanks for recommending it. And greetings from the +49. That was nice.
Woo-hoo.
And Justin from the 561 said, I want to quickly thank you for mentioning the A word right out of the gate on episode 91. As someone who has lived with high functioning autism my entire life, I had my own reasons for being interested to watch the show and did end up really liking it, but it makes me very happy to find out that people who aren't me also seem to like it. So that was very nice.
Nice.
I don't have a Dean of the 707 travel update this week. He probably went to some state, but again,
right.
We aren't listening. We are holograms.
Dean, we're there for you.
Yeah.
You are in Rio.
Wherever you are. but he did get back a couple weeks ago. We talked about whether we should meet up on like December 19th in a bar in San Francisco for an informal TVTM meetup, and Dean will have returned from his travels at that point, or will be traveling through San Francisco and will need a bar for California. And he wrote in to say they could make that work if we choose to do it. So I think we got to continue
packing on us, right?
Continue zeroing in on December 19th as a possible date. Again, we've got a lot of time between now and then to screw this up, but
exactly
there it is. All right. Gary in the 818/310, he can't decide what part of LA he's from. Gary says, I wonder what you attribute the massive Emmy nomination shift to this year. Aside from Tim's campaigning for the Americans to receive a nod, clearly there were other powerful forces in play to write all of those historical snubs. What are they? I figure surely it had to be the shift to streaming and the ease in which Emmy voters could watch all those different series. Since they were already watching Netflix, it wasn't a technical stretch to watch Hulu or Amazon or to download the various network apps. Do you know if traditional physical screener copies were distributed less with more focused on internet delivery? I'm curious to hear your thoughts. What do you think?
Well, there definitely have been moving to get people to be able to see it in more ways than just getting screeners. You can stream it. But basically, they changed some of the rules about who can vote and what voting blocks can vote. They got rid of these, what they called blue ribbon panels. But also, I just think that that was helpful, too. But look, I think that I think that just part of it was you never know what kind of lobbying is going on in the background. But if you're running a big organization like that, and I could be giving them more credit than they deserve, but you know, you're starting to see these groups, not just because there's race issues involved and imbalances. I think you're seeing these kind of staid awards groups getting their act together because they've either been embarrassed or shamed to the point where like, hey, let's get this right. And either that or just more people more proactive in the leadership role saying, hey, let's do better and we can do better and we've changed the rules to make it do better. You need to do your part at home by streaming these things, make a more educated guess, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of things that go into that. It's not just that people have more and more efficient ways of watching shows. I think that there are people who are more on it. I mean, the one of the big knocks for a long time was that there was an argument that a lot of these people were not watching television and that they had never seen the shows nor heard of them, and that's why they were getting missed out. So I think at some level you got to give at least the voters credit for doing what they're supposed to be doing, and it's hard. Everybody's got a job. people are working on other shows, people are acting, etc. But yeah, for whatever reason, I think they're doing a much better job.
I have another Emmy letter here. This is from Mike in the 407.
All right.
Says, Tim and Jason, the Emmy nominations pretty much went down the way I expected. There remains, however, one hope of mine that has sadly yet to be fulfilled. For Bob's Burgers, a high-quality animated series to be considered among the best in comedy. It's rare to have a series that has consistently displayed kick-ass writing through its subversive humor, awesome animation, and wonderful characters. Also exceptional is to remain sharp over a long period of time with a large number of episodes under the belt, just as The Simpsons accomplished during its golden age. The omission, while disheartening, does not surprise me. While respect and acceptance for animation has grown over the decades, there unfortunately remains a misconception among some voters who still perceive the medium as a genre instead of an art form. That's a shame. The artists and voice actors behind these shows have worked tirelessly to bring to life characters from which we can all relate, laugh at, and cry alongside. Their artistic mindset is no different from that of the writers and actors of live-action programs. The Flintstones proved that back in 1960 when it made the first crack at the glass ceiling. Many cartoons then have followed in its path of weaving stories that broke new ground in observing the human condition. They left cracks of their own through the durable roof and have played a vital role in the new golden age of television. But the canopy has yet to be broken. Unlike live-action shows and animated shows, animated works' most daunting challenge during award season is to be invited. Live-action shows have benefited from the enlargement of major categories. By contrast, it remains a rarity to find a cartoon up in those groups. Will we ever see a cartoon finally break the glass ceiling? Would enlarging the categories or membership be enough to bring more animated shows to the table? Mike Ryan, an animator from the 407.
Wow. No, I don't. I mean, I think that was a big deal for a while. I mean, I get what he's saying, and I agree on all points. I would just say this. I think that when the animated category got better, right? So I think pretty much everybody in the animated category this year is pretty strong. I think winning in that group, because, you know, back when you just had The Simpsons or you had a couple of, you know, one-offs or whatever, and you'd think, well, this show's really funny. It's as good as anything else. It should be in. And that was the argument, was mostly for in the heyday of The Simpsons, that they should be included. But now there's so much animation and so many different styles of it that I think that there's no lack of respect. There's no lack of prestige to battle it out amongst your peers, because your peers are better. That would be my thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you take Bob's Burgers, which is a fantastic series, one of the funniest shows on television. I don't think you do it a service sticking that in with, you know, the group of best comedy. You know, I think that's a really tough group to be in, because technically you're Bob's Burgers going against Transparent. You know, I don't get that. Like I never mind that Transparent, I think, is more of a drama than a comedy. It's in that category. I just don't think that they fit. I think it fits better in its own animated category. And the fact that there's so much better animated competition next to it it works for me. And also, like, I see I see the point, but I think it's easier for people to say, well, do I like Master of None and what it was doing with Aziz Ansari, or do I like Bob's Burgers? I think that it's almost, you know what I mean? I mean, it's a little bit of apples and oranges, even though everybody's talented in what they do. I prefer to keep them separate.
I get what he's saying about it. It's an art form, and animation is just a different style. But I could argue the point that animated shows and live action shows are different enough that it's a way to split them up and honor more shows. And that, I guess it is true that just like with the Oscars, you know, if you can't, if an animated show, movie can never really be Best Picture because it's just not going to get that recognition, that stinks on one level. But on another level, You're honoring more stuff when you create an animated category and you have that category. And you could argue that the drama and comedy categories are basically live action is a, yeah. like a footnote there. It's the same reason why there isn't a, you know, there are all those reality and categories and things like that, which are,
right.
and talk and variety and things like that too. They're all shows and a lot of them are scripted and yet they're also split up. It's a way you split things up in order to honor more things more than anything else, I think is what's happening. But I do think they get their due in many ways as it, I don't think it's like it was in the past. I think people recognize there's so many amazing animated shows now that, maybe not most people, but many people understand now that they're not, you know, cartoons for the kids, you know, it's not Scooby-Doo that's happening.
Right. Exactly.
I have another animation letter for you. And this one is from Patrick from the +49. Patrick says, I'm a relatively new listener. I've been slowly catching up on back episodes. I caught episode 64. Oh, you got a long slog ahead of you before you hear this letter, Patrick, where you discussed Tim's long list of 2015 favorites. I was happy to hear you praise Archer and Bob's Burgers. However, my favorite animated show was absent, BoJack Horseman. Has this passed you by, or were you turned off by the slightly weaker first couple of episodes? In my opinion, the way that BoJack tackles surprisingly heavy topics like depression or failure on top of its biting Hollywood satire makes it one of the strongest comedies on TV right now. Yeah, there are a lot of silly animals as people jokes, but in time I've even grown to love those. Not unlike the similarly themed You're the Worst, I think BoJack deserves a critical reappraisal and has already gotten it from many fans and critics. Patrick from the +49 should say BoJack Horseman is about to come back or just came back. I'm not sure.
Yes.
For a new
mm-hmm.
season. What do you think about BoJack Horseman?
You know, I think BoJack Horseman comes back tonight, as a matter of fact. Yes, it's tonight. Actually, it was
a week ago.
It was a week ago.
Hello from the past.
You know, if you go into the future and try to change things, it's bad things happen. Jason,
it's complicated, and it got renewed for a fourth season. The third season is on Netflix now, and I've heard from people who love it too, so I mean,
yeah,
you're not alone, Patrick.
And but I'm with him in that I struggled with the first few episodes, and it turned me off to the point where I was like, you know what, does it get better? And people said it got better, but I, at the time, I was like, I don't have time to get through this. And only in this current round that started a week ago of people chattering endlessly about how great BoJack Horseman is again in, what is this, fourth season, that or third season, it's just doing so great, did it come back to my mind like, yeah, I'm going to put that on my list as catch up and get to it. But I gotta say, maybe it's like Parks and Recreation or any of the 30 Rock or any of the other shows where the first three or four, sometimes five episodes were not very good. I got into the first three of BoJack Horseman season one, and it was not doing it for me, so I gave up on it. But I will revisit because people keep talking about it, so I'm sure it did get better.
I got one from MVP. My Vogue on Poetry.
Uh-huh.
It's our buddy in the 716.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is in the music show category of can we make a good TV show about music, about rock and roll? And he says, I love the world of the Nick Hornby book and movie High Fidelity. The record store employees with their passion for organizing vinyl and making lists would make for a rich world of misfits who are usually much more interesting than the musicians themselves. Get Mackenzie Crook from The Office to direct, who made a cinematic and heartfelt show about metal detector hobbyists called Detectorists. I have heard good things about Detectorists.
I have too, yes.
Mark me down for at least three series, and please, no one has to get murdered. Okay. My Vogue on Poetry. I love the book and I love the movie. I'm not sure what a TV adaptation would do, and I'm not sure whether that's quite the same as being about the musicians themselves, but I think a great adaptation could be made of High Fidelity as a TV show. Sure. What do you think?
I do. I think it could be that's out there. I think that could be a great show. I would watch it. I think you're always going to say, okay, what's the next episode? Where's the show? Is there a show in here? Or do they do the same thing over and over again? And is it a little too niche oriented when you're talking about all this music? I would watch the hell out of that show. But it's not exactly what I was talking about. I want to see something actually about the music. I want to see the music played.
Right.
I want to
not on a record.
Yeah. And although that would work too. There's certainly that you know, I find it odd, though. You'd have to have these long periods where you'd be actually listening to the music. I mean, I don't want to just hear it on the background inside of a record store.
No, you need a scene like that Dry the Rain scene where they, you know, he turns it up and we listen to Dry the Rain by the Beta Band for like a good minute and a half. And there's not a lot of dialogue happening. And that would be a weird kind of thing. You could do it, but it would be weird.
You could do it. Yeah. And I'm not against it. I certainly think that's that's a possibility. But yeah, I'm thinking more along the lines of I want something about the industry rather than just total fan base. But yeah, I'm on for... Look, how about this? How about we have both shows? I'd be happy.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yep.
Trevor in the 661 says, I'm late, but I have a good example of a show that was revamped between seasons. Remember, we were talking about revamps. Yes. He says, Bob... On CBS, the Bob Newhart show, because the joke was he did the Bob Newhart show, and then he did Newhart, and then he did Bob. And this was, he was an unhappy greeting card artist who quit his job when a publisher wanted to revitalize his old superhero character. The first season focused on Bob's home life, and his wife and adult daughter, as well as a workplace of eccentrics. Despite lousy ratings, they renewed the show and overhauled it. At the end of the first season, the company was sold and everyone was fired. In season two, only the wife, the daughter, and Bob returned. He went back to the greeting card company, and Betty White and Jerry Burns joined the cast. I think that's a good one. It actually, the reason I picked this letter is because Newhart, not Bob, Newhart also did this, where the first season was multi-camera, shot on video, had a bunch of different characters who got or at least a few different characters who got removed. And when they came back for the second season, they had a bunch of new characters, including Peter Scolari and Julia Duffy, who became kind of breakout characters on that show. And it was now a single camera shot on film sitcom. And that's the show that people remember as Newhart, even though, yeah, the Vermont inn was still a part of it. The premise didn't change, but a lot of the cast and the entire look of the show changed between season one and season two. Like, almost as stark a difference as when you go from like the black and white episodes of Gilligan's Island or Bewitched to the color episodes. If you've ever seen one of those old black and white episodes, you're like, what am I seeing? Because they just don't look like the same shows. Newhart was like that too. So I guess Bob Newhart is no stranger to revamps, is what I'm saying.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a little TV.
That was before my time.
Somebody's going to write in and say, but that you I think you meant Falcon Crest. So you can just go ahead and do that. Joel from the 218 wrote in and said, please forward this idea to the appropriate creative executives to negotiate my rights. On a recent episode, you were looking for ideas for an IT-related show, technology-related show, and you said it could be hard to make because showing people typing and screens of information isn't exciting. But there's plenty of material to make a great show. The IT show, as any good show, would be about the characters. See Halt and Catch Fire, for an example. Tech is just the environment. Essentially, make Mad Men in a tech company. I thought that was Halt and Catch Fire. But he says, just think about great tech personas. Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, people like that. There's an unlimited canvas of character situations that could be explored, creation of products, marketing of products. Also sounds a little bit like Silicon Valley, but maybe like some kind of combination of those, a little more dramatic. And this is me. I'm summarizing now.
I see what you're doing there. Yes. It sounds very much like the other show.
Halt and Catch Fire and Silicon Valley sort of do this now, but two companies pitted against each other, deadlines, product launches, failures, corporate politics. I can see it. I mean, there could be something there, but write the show around great characters that you care about. I think he's right about that. Joel from the 218.
Yeah. I think that's Halt and Catch Fire.
Yeah.
But, which by the way, season 3 is going to start soon.
Very soon.
And they're moving from
it's a week sooner
Texas
than you think even.
Yeah, a week sooner than I think. They're moving from Texas to Silicon Valley.
That's finally.
So there you go. That's that show.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else do we have here? Here's a good one. It's Dear TVTM, I wish to... Am I on? I think I'm on. This is Jenny from down the block. By reading this email, Jason has activated a virus that allowed me to temporarily take over the podcast while using a voice synthesizer to sound just like him, even the mistakes, to help me remain undetected. Anyway, the reason I did this is the other week, Dan in the Secret City asked about notable sci-fi shows to watch this summer, and instead of his usual excellent answers, Jason gave some lame response about not knowing what to recommend because he wants to have a life or something instead of keeping up on 50 gazillion shows. Whatever. Jeffers. Although I do agree with him, you should watch the semi-sci-fi show Mr. Robot. So here's what he should have said. You should watch Killjoys and Dark Matter. From what I've seen, most sci-fi geeks who try those two shows like one of them a lot. However, it varies from person to person which one they think is clearly the superior show and whether they think the other one is even worth watching. Personally, I initially like Killjoys better at the beginning, but enjoyed Dark Matter much more later on. Others disagree. Try a few episodes of both and see what side you're on. Both shows are very sequential, so you should go back and watch them from the beginning of season one, except that the two-episode Dark Matter pilot is awful. This is Jason. She's right about that. So I'd recommend skipping it and just play close attention to the episode recap at the beginning of episode three. Ouch, burn. Hope this helps. Anyway, Jason should just be finishing with my fake cover letter, so let's return to the podcast. And for those six reasons, that's why I think it's clear The Riches will be picked up by Netflix next season. Jenny from down the block in the 650.
Wow. Okay, right.
Bravo.
Very good.
It's fine. I haven't seen Killjoy, so maybe that's the one I would like. And I did watch those first two episodes of Dark Matter, and they stunk. But hey,
I hear good things about Killjoys. Yeah, I have not had time to do it. So you'll be surprised how many TV critics have a hard time watching other shows.
So nerd alert, if people who have more time than me want to watch, are looking for that sci-fi show for the summer, try those out. Jenny from down the block in the 650 says Killjoys, Dark Matter. Give those a run. You'll like one of them.
That was nerdtastic.
Yep. I thought so.
I sat back in awe.
It's pretty good, right?
And as the TV critic, I sat back and said, yes, I have heard of those shows.
Yeah, that's right. Good job, Tim. Good job. I'll give you a little applause for
it. It's like watching
awareness.
A game that I'm not playing. It's like it's Latin.
It's good to be aware of things.
Yeah.
Okay, we got a couple more. Chris from the 253 Tacoma, Washington. Thank you, Chris, for specifying that.
Nice.
Saved us time. I have greatly enjoyed your podcast and love trying out new shows you recommend. I've noticed, though, that I generally have more trouble with the shows that are historical dramas, like Manhattan or Halt and Catch Fire, where the characters and story are intertwined with actual historical events, versus period dramas like Mad Men or Downton Abbey, where historical events take place in the background. I think the problem is that my knowledge of actual history gets in the way, either by spoiling the show or taking away authenticity when I know they're over-dramatizing the events. The reason I'm bringing this up now is my wife and I started watching The Americans, finally, and I'm worried this factor might turn me off again based on a couple of the first episodes. My question is, have either of you been turned off by a show because of the way it uses history in the story, and how bad does it get with The Americans?
I think we're pretty fine with The Americans. I think you can nitpick some things, but he's only watched the first couple, so.
Well, he's talking about, like, the first season they mentioned, like, the Reagan assassination attempt.
Right.
It comes up. We're not in a parallel universe a week from now where Ronald Reagan was actually assassinated. The assassination attempt on Reagan plays into the events a little bit, but, you know, that was, and I, as somebody who lived through that, I actually thought that was pretty great, but yeah.
Yeah, I there was, you know, it's funny. I a good friend of mine, Robert Bianco, who's the TV critic at USA Today and my mentor, he really has trouble because his knowledge of history is fantastic. So anytime you go back and you do a lot of the actual history, for example, he struggled with on Showtime when they did. Help me out here, Jason. I know what you're talking about. When they had Jonathan Rhys-Meyers.
Oh, the Tudors?
which, you know, the young, sexy, lean, handsome King Henry.
Yeah.
They would say in the tiny print, they'd say in the history, you know, in our desire to move the plot quickly, we're turning two sisters into one, or you know what I mean? That's the kind of thing that would drive him crazy. So,
I made
Rome
fun of like Rain, right? On the CW.
Oh, well, that one
reason,
was a disaster.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, but I guess what I'm saying is I'm a little more forgiving than some people. Like Robert had trouble with that. I loved Rome, and Rome had a lot of inconsistencies, in them. And so somebody who is a history buff is going to be really struggle exactly like this is being said, like he's saying. And so I think he's actually right. And in fact, I actually, not a history buff, but know enough about it. I actually liked Mad Men in kind of the similar way he did as well, because I didn't want anything from the 60s to be bubbling up and being a 60s melodrama. I wanted it to be about Don Draper and the existential crisis. So I liked that stuff tamped down. I don't like it at the top, because you do have these historical inaccuracies. And some of them, I will tell you, some of them I'm unaware of, so they go over my head, whereas like Robert would go, like, that's ridiculous. And sometimes when you distort the facts so much, like they've done in any number of stuff about kings and queens of the past, it drives people like Robert crazy, and sometimes to an extent me. So I'm kind of with you on the letter writer on this one for sure.
I anachronisms drive me crazy, and music is one of those things.
That happened with
Mad Men every now and then, but I also remember seeing shows set in the 70s and the 80s where they use music from like 1984 in something set in 1981. And yeah. I just been like, no, wrong. Where they're like, it's the 80s. It doesn't really matter. And they just, I realize on one level, it totally doesn't matter. And yet, if you're going to set something in a period and try to get a tone of that period by picking something that's not actually from that period, you're not getting the tone of that period. You set it in 1984 then, if you want to use music from 1984. But if you're going to set it in 1982, you need to use music from 1982. And I'm gonna throw in, this is not quite what he's talking about, because this is actually period stuff that's not historical, but is period, and it still bugs me, is Stranger Things on Netflix, which is set in the 80s, and it's about kids in the 80s, and it's sort of Stephen King-esque, and I've heard a lot of people like it. I've watched the first couple episodes. I'm kind of mixed on it. One of the things that bugs me about it, though, is the anachronisms, because they say stuff that people didn't say 30 years ago.
Right.
There's like, just dialogue things that I'm like, nobody talked like that back then. And I get, like, you can't... I mean, they're trying to make it understandable for people today, I guess. But it's like, if you're going to do it, period, you should do it right. And the anachronisms just drive me nuts, and it takes me out of the show, because I'm like, that doesn't make sense. That isn't right. And I know that's nitpicking on one level, but another level, if it lights up the lantern and makes me go, oh, something that's not quite right, it's still taking me out of the show. Whether I can forgive it as a dumb decision or not, it still pulled me out of the show.
Right. And I think that letter just got, I think, more interesting, because because it opens up more thoughts and floodgates. But I mean, for example, based on what you just said, I think if you acknowledge that you're going to be anachronistic in the storytelling, then I'm okay with it. So here's just a couple of things. Mad Men was period detailed to the point. Everything was like super research. They made a couple of mistakes, but they didn't make a lot of mistakes in a 7-season run, which is amazing. But what drove me crazy, and I would talk to Matt Weiner about it, is like, okay, why did you decide? I mean, I think they did it maybe more than two times, but two times very distinctly they used modern music in scenes. And one was the Decemberists, and I forget the other one was, but it's like, oh, it literally drove me insane. And I was like, why did you do that? And he's just like, you know what? I just, it was the song for the moment. And you know, he made the series. He can make that decision. But it seemed so wildly inconsistent. It was like, you're 98% like to the T, but then every now and then you say, I'm not gonna, that really bugs me. On the other hand, the guys who created, the woman and the man who created Underground, on WGN, which is a really interesting series, and I think more so if you go into it knowing that they planned to do that. So you have a historic story about the slaves in the Underground Railroad, and it's super modern. And when they first showed it to us, it was like, people were like, wait, nobody talked like that. And you had all this current 20, I think at the time it was 2015, I think, when they showed it to us. Maybe it was early 2016, but... people are like, no, this is, you can't do this. This is going to be a disaster. But you know, that was the early stages. That was at TCA. Once the show was about to come out, they said, look, we did this on purpose. We want this. This is a historic story, but we want to tell stories from that period, and we want a brand new audience. I mean, we're going to have these, this kind of anachronistic storytelling. And for me, once you acknowledge that, I'm okay with it. The two other things I'll quickly say, and they're divergent takes on this timeline. One of my very good friends, Ben, knows everything about cars, and he's a savant about cars. Like, a car can be going by at 40 miles an hour, I'll barely see the color, and like, if you were to ask me what color it was, it's blue. He would say make, model, year, and then tell you that how rare it was because of that one, they changed the motor out and they turned it sideways and they did some other thing. Or they added a fuel injection. I mean, he's crazy. So he's impossible to watch like a show about the Americans because it's the cars. He should be on the podcast at some point talking about shows that ruined it for him because it's like the cars. He looks at the cars, he's like, oh my God, I can't watch this. Like, there's, you know, whereas those guys are probably just trying to fill the screen with all these old cars. He's like, oh, you couldn't have that Ford, whatever. That was one and a half years out of make. That they were, you know, all, it was, he can't watch it.
That's some serious not a thing happening.
Oh my God, he was in with cars. And then I'm like, when we watched something, I'm like, Ben, shh, yeah. No one cares. No one but no you one knows. Else. It's you and two other people in America losing their shit.
I see computer stuff like that all the time, where it's just like, that's not the right computer for that era, but it's like, whatever. It's close enough. I was actually going to say the Americans, from my perspective as somebody who lived through the 80s, the Americans gets the 80s way closer than like Stranger Things does. That's where I see the level of detail. They're playing on a higher level in terms of that than something like Stranger Things, where it's like they're equipping. And it's not like they've got like iPhones in Stranger Things and it's the 80s, but like the way they talk and some of the set dressing stuff, it's like, yeah, that's probably not period accurate. And
well, who wrote the letter?
This is Chris. In the 253.
Sorry, Chris. I forgot your man.
Tacoma.
I said Tacoma, Chris. I would say the letter writer. I completely like lost the name. I would say to Chris, unless Jason has something else to add to this thing, the one show that you might be able to watch, Chris, and get by with is, if you haven't already, is the sitcom The Goldbergs, set in the 1980s. Huh. Because I love the fact that they make no bones about the fact that it's like, yeah, it's 80s, not like he's like, what is it set? He's like, 80s. We don't so like, you never know, like the idea, they don't care, they just want everything about the 80s to be represented. It doesn't have to actually be in the yearly order.
It's in the magical, it's like how Happy Days was in the 50s or MASH was during the Korean War, and it's like no details. Just trust us.
I love it. It freed them up to make fun of things that came to them in the moment or actually fit the story, and it didn't have to be year centric.
That's good. Yeah. Two more. So you may remember I have read a few letters from Yehuda, who I said in the last one I said she was writing from Israel. Okay, I got some corrections to do here.
Okay,
he was writing from Switzerland usually, although he writes us now from Israel. So there you go. See,
really,
I knew that Yehuda had an Israel connection, but why do I keep saying collections? I don't know. It's late in the week.
In the future.
It is. That's right. It's time
late
travel.
In the future.
It has an effect on me. Anyway,
does.
Yehuda, he writes, "Hi guys, let me come back to this topic. I was watching the Canadian version of Mr. Robot. I'm not going to even ask how you get that in Switzerland on the Showcase channel. I think it's probably fell off the back of a truck." He said, "I noticed the F word is used openly, both spoken and written. I was curious whether this was the case on American cable TV as well, and if not, how the USA Network chose to mask it. Have you noticed that?
They're masking it, yes.
Yeah, they just fuzz things and drop out the audio.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, that's how they've been doing it. So it's like with the Magicians we were talking about. It's shot for no censorship at all. And then the network is, and I'm still unclear on this about whether they're doing it like before a certain time and if they might not censor it after midnight if they do a late night showing. But certainly they're just dipping out the sound and fuzzing up bad words on the screen if they need to. And that's just part of their standards and practices.
It wouldn't surprise me.
It wouldn't. Surprise me. That would require actual research. We're not going to go that far. Okay, I've got one more.
All right.
And this is a very short one. It's a tweet. It's from Tim Windsor, who wrote us to say, "Be afraid. Be very afraid." And he sent us a link to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution with this headline. Florida man. Okay, you know it's going to be good, right?
Yeah, it's going to be good now.
Finds our new greatest fear, gator in a tree. So as our friend Tim says, drop gators. Be very afraid.
I gotta tell you, I saw that picture and I froze. I was like, the world is insane. There was alligator in a tree, and I thought, this changes everything.
Yeah.
We're being hunted.
Don't go to Florida. Drop gators are there.
So, strangely, I didn't think drop gators, though. So thank you, Tim.
It's America's Australia, Florida. So just don't go there.
I did tell somebody the drop grizzly story, whereas Americans were considered one up the drop bear.
Well, we got it now.
Well, now we've got drop grizzlies. We don't need, drop gators. We don't need drop grizzlies.
No, we don't.
Oh my God.
All right. We're done. This is the holograms. The holograms are breaking up.
You really are.
TVTM on Twitter. Send us notes. You can email us podcast@tvtalkmachine.com. Visit us on Facebook, facebook.com/TVTalkMachine. I'm Jay Snell on Twitter. Tim is Bastard Machine on Twitter. You can find Tim's stuff at The Hollywood Reporter. Tim will be in residence writing a lot, I assume, about the Death March with Cocktails, the summer press tour. And we will be back next week at some point with a special live and in-person from Beverly Hills report from Tim. But until then, I just got to say, Tim, I know you're already there, but since I'm a hologram, I'm gonna say I hope you're having a good time and continue to have an okay time at the Death March. Godspeed.
Thank you. I will tell you from the future, I'm not.
No, didn't think so. Okay. And thanks to everybody out there for listening. Bye, everybody.
Bye.